Prepare to be astonished.
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Mac Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
Good evening, and welcome to an adventure in history. We are well into 2022. It's still January, and we're still here.
And we are still here.
Yeah.
We've survived so far.
We are. And I mean, it's almost February at this point.
Well, I don't know about that. But
getting
there. And even though your daughter's not here, I'm like making noises.
I know. You're being the loud one today.
I'm dropping stuff on the table, and it's kind of loud. It's like my mic is right there on the
table. Do I need to give you some activities to do?
Maybe. I have to say that your daughter is very well behaved.
She is, yes.
I mean, she has endured sitting here twice now.
That's the six-year-old, not the two-year-old.
That's true. Would the two-year-old be different?
Probably. She did. She's probably been to the most, though, because she came when she
That's
was a newborn, right?
Right? Like, yeah. She was on the air before Carly was on the
like
air.
She was like a month old, and we brought her
We used to go to commercial when she started making noises.
I know.
And it was kind of timed perfectly, her nap time.
It worked until it didn't.
That's funny. But this is so exciting. Our first guest of the year.
Yes.
And it might be all downhill after this.
One of our favorites.
It is.
She's a repeat.
A three-time.
Yeah, this is my third time.
Third time. So we're not going to get into your background, but it is the most fabulous curator in the world.
And she hasn't earned a t-shirt yet. So
not
you have
a t-shirt.
Three more to go.
There's a t-shirt?
There's a t-shirt.
We've been promising t-shirts for 12 years now.
Has anyone actually gotten a t-shirt?
No.
Oh.
We have to design them. See, I'm kind of picturing to pay proper homage to the different co-hosts. I've lasted the longest. But
somehow.
We had Paulette, and then we had Julie, and now we have you.
Yes.
So I picture, because we can't just put you and me on a t-shirt.
No.
That would be a little unfair.
So maybe it's just the three of us.
Well, it could be, but I'm picturing like a Charlie's Angels thing, and I'm like Bosley in the background. So I don't know.
We could think about that.
I actually have started to talk to an historian style though.
So
maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe
books
to,
and
maybe
glasses.
Maybe have to be wearing like 1800s outfits.
Sure.
I have talked to an artist. So at least we're further along than we were a year ago.
Okay.
So someday you might have a t-shirt that you'll never wear.
Right. I look forward to it.
But it's Chelsea Vaughn, Dr. Chelsea Vaughn. So we're excited that you're here on very short notice.
A little bit, yes.
So we do appreciate that. I got History Hollies. Do we have anything else we got to talk about before we get going?
Let's go.
Because this is going to be a good show. It's going to be all about self-promotion for the Historical Society today.
I love it. Hey.
Shameless self-promotion.
Incredibly shameless.
All right. So these are the things that you can brag about tomorrow. So you can be smart. And again, as always, if you are involved in any wagering, we need to get a piece of the action if you win.
Ooh, yes.
So January 10th, 1941, FDR introduces the Lend-Lease program to aid Britain in World War II.
Good one.
Did we do more lending or more leasing?
Hmm.
I kind of think we did more leasing.
Probably, yeah.
In the big scheme of things.
Right.
So it worked out for us.
Right.
Although it worked out for Britain, too.
Right. They did okay.
Because they could have been suddenly taken over by Nazis, but they were not. 1946, the first meeting of the United Nations.
Oh, that's a good one.
And the world has had nothing but peace since then.
Right.
Although I do like the United Nations.
Sure, yes.
1946, the U.S. Army bounces the first radar signal off the moon from Fort Monmouth, New Jersey. I don't know why. It kind of counts as space stuff.
It does. It's interesting. Like, why did they do it?
I don't know. To see if there's anything in between.
Okay.
I wonder how long it took to bounce the system.
Oh, man.
To bounce the radar wave or whatever it is. All right. 1956, Chelsea's beginning to rethink why she came here today. She's like, you're a moron. 1956, Elvis records Heartbreak Hotel.
Oh, fun.
I don't know if it's my favorite Elvis song or not.
Oh, no. Blue Moon.
Blue Moon, really?
Oh, yes.
Wow. I would not have predicted
that.
Not
Heartbreak Hotel. No.
Well, no, I don't. It's up there, though. It's an easy one to sing if you're doing an Elvis impersonation, which I'm not going to do.
Oh, good.
1967, PBS begins.
Love that.
It's a 70-station network.
Good.
I wonder what areas didn't have one.
Oh.
How sad for them. 1999, The Sopranos debuts on HBO.
Oh, interesting.
I was not a fan, but then I binge watched it after it was all over. Because I didn't want to jump in, but then I thought, well, I've got to know what everybody's talking about. I actually enjoyed it.
Well, not my cup of tea.
Yeah, so. Oh, well, it was a lot of gratuitous violence and sex. Yes, but exactly. But the storyline, and James Gandolfi, or however you pronounce his name, is actually, he was quite fun to watch.
I do like a lot of the actors in it. Yes.
Yeah. It's kind of like The Walking Dead. I could do without all the zombies and all the gratuitous violence. I like the story.
Oh, okay.
But
the way they present it.
Yeah. I don't need the zombies. I don't need the gore. I don't need, you could just tell this great story.
I think that's called books. It could be.
Oh, I like books too. All right. But our history highlight of the day, the thing I think had the most impact on history, 1901, Gusher signals start of U.S. oil industry. A drilling derrick at Spindle Top Hill near Beaumont, Texas, produces an enormous gusher of crude oil, coating the landscape for hundreds of feet and signaling the advent of the American oil industry. The geyser was discovered at a depth of over 1,000 feet, flowed at an initial rate of approximately 100,000 barrels a day, and took 9 days to cap. Following the discovery, petroleum, which until that time had been used in the U.S. primarily as a lubricant and in kerosene for lamps, would become the main fuel source for new inventions such as cars and airplanes. Coal-powered forms of transportation, including ships and trains, would also convert to liquid fuel.
Wow.
So oil.
Yes.
Even though Standard Oil begins like 20 years beforehand, but like 1880 or so.
But is that a U.S. company?
Oh, well, isn't Standard Oil Rockefeller?
Yeah, you might be right. Yeah, yeah. I'll be honest, fume oil is not my area of expertise.
Well, it's not mine either. But I kind of thought that even if Standard Oil was beforehand, that this was really kind of a...
Sure, turning point.
A turning point, and therefore, ergo, had the most impact on history.
For sure.
What'd I miss?
You missed Florida history.
Well, I blocked Florida out.
1861, they seceded from the Union.
Oh, boo-hiss, Florida.
Yes.
What do you think?
They were one of the six original southern states to form the Confederate States. So I think that a lot of people can probably agree that Florida maybe still thinks that they're not part of the Union.
They
Having lived there, I can say that because I lived in South Florida and I lived in North Florida, and neither one recognizes the other one, and they are one state. So,
see, my brother moved there for his postdoc, and any correspondence we had since then, for a good like 25 years, he would end it with his name and then in Florida, America's playground. So I always used to mock that wherever I was living.
Yes.
Somehow. So
it is very nice, but it's very different. And it definitely is a different...
It's shiny and new.
I don't know about that.
Well, maybe not so shiny or new anymore.
Yeah.
So I like picking on Florida.
Yes.
There are a lot of states I like picking on.
Yes. They're just easy.
That's the thing. Yeah. It's probably too easy.
Yep.
So what's not easy is creating exhibits.
You're right.
How was that for a segue?
That was a great segue. Yes.
Well, I don't know about that. So, Chelsea, you've been our curator, our fabulous curator for 4+ years now.
Yes, it was 4 years in August.
Okay. I figured it was still closer to say four than to five.
We'll say four. I actually was asked this question earlier today, and I had to think about it, and I was a little surprised by the answer. So,
surprised by how long you've been here or how short you've been here?
How long? I guess... maybe it's just been such magic fun that it feels like it's gone so fast and feels like less time.
It does creep up on you.
Yeah.
Because I had that. It wasn't until our mayor started pointing out longest tenured director that I kind of realized, wow, it has been forever at this point. So, but we've got two exciting exhibits. One will never be complete, but it is on exhibit at this point.
Right.
And then the other one you were in the process of. So, barring you just wanting to go somewhere else here in a different direction, I thought like the best way to open this up would be to briefly discuss both exhibits and then talk about what goes into planning an exhibit.
Okay. Oh, absolutely. Yes. So you're correct. We have two exciting exhibits, one that is open, but also ever evolving, which I'll explain a bit more about that momentarily. And then also another, which we are in the process very diligently of assembling. One of our smaller galleries and then our largest gallery. So it's two, honestly, very different processes. Mm-hmm. The exhibit that's currently open is Blocked Out, Race and Place in the Making of Modern Astoria. That exhibit was done in conjunction with Oregon Black Pioneers. They are a fantastic organization that was a huge amount of help on creating this exhibit. The exhibit examines, how Astoria has its very, current demographics, which are overwhelmingly white, and kind of interrogates the idea of is Astoria white because it's always been white? And the answer is, well, no. Mm-hmm. So We look at sort of historically what communities have been here, and then also what events have happened that has really, you know, changed and shaped the contemporary demographics. And we also do this, we try to tie it to geography or to place, rather than just saying, oh, well, you know, here's Astoria and, you know, some racist policies occurred or something's happened. We're like, oh no, right here, this specific event happened. And so we can look at things more closely and kind of examine them as more concrete ideas, I feel, was kind of the premise behind tying it to place.
Well, and it does, along those lines, I think it makes it a little more real when it's, oh my gosh, I know that building, I love that building, and something happened there. And it doesn't make the building evil or horrible, but it does make us rethink a little bit the stories that that building can tell.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the very building that we are in right now was the City Hall when the Klan comes to power. It was the whites-only USO during World War II. So, you know, the Heritage Museum itself, it has its own story. And these, you know, and that doesn't make necessarily the building, like you said, evil, but it does make it complicated. And it makes it, you have to look at things and think, well, okay, so this is the history that's happened in this space. And how does that, you know, how do we interact with that? How do we think about that? How do we try to amend that? You know, how do we, and that doesn't mean necessarily that, you know, we can build a time machine and go back and not elect the Klan to sit to, you know, run the town, but it does mean that we need to think about that in a less abstract way. And that's why, like you said, like it ties it to a place, you know, because we often tell the story of the Klan, like they came to power, the city burns down, they leave power, without really thinking about what them being in power, that's something that, you know, again, occurs in a physical space, that it occurs in the physical space that we happen to be occupying at the moment.
I think especially with the Klan, we have tended, and I put myself in that same category, try to oversimplify it.
Absolutely.
And I think this exhibit and your efforts and Zachary helping us from Black Pioneers with his input, that we're trying to make maybe history not so simple. And we're not changing the history, but we're trying to broaden the viewpoints.
Yeah, absolutely.
Does that make sense?
That makes complete sense. No, that's, again, the Klan is a great example of how the local history has, how historically we've simplified history. But again, with the story very much that, you know, 1922, the Klan is elected, city burns down a month later, though importantly, the Klan's not actually in office yet when the city burns down. And then the Klan kind of just goes away. But, you know, you start looking at the historic record, and that's not the case, right? You have 1924, 1925, you have these massive Klan rallies and demonstrations locally. You know, you can look at the census and see that the, you know, small but consistent African-American community we had in Astoria just disappears entirely during that time period. You know, there's other countings where, you know, the Jewish population shrinks locally, things of that nature. So it is a much more complicated story that does affect multiple communities.
So when you were researching this exhibit, because you ended up with there's a lot of print and there's a lot of words. So yes. When people come in here, it can feel overwhelming. But then like you said, you are then kind of taken into a moment in time. So what was your thought when you were finding all of this information to get it out there?
Well, and to talk briefly on Mac's point that the exhibit is not yet complete, is that this is an ever-evolving exhibit, that even since it's been open for approximately a month now, we've had some additional instances, accounting stories added to it already. That doesn't mean that I've gone in and like altered the entire exhibit to accommodate them, but it does mean that I've started adding those on to thinking about if we were to say, you know, redo this exhibit in the future or things of that purpose. But it is an overwhelming amount of information. When I was researching it, you know, once you start digging, and we didn't just want things that were hearsay, we wanted things that we could actually concretely document, and again, to a geographic location. So it was something that, you know, there were honestly things I came across in my research that I couldn't include because I couldn't really confirm them. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, things that were confirmed, things that had a clear connection to this place. And it ended up being a lot of research, but then it ended up also being a lot of material. And thinking about it and thinking like, well, this is a lot of information for this exhibit. What can we cut? And the answer was, well, not really anything, because how do you make that decision that one person's story is less relevant than another person's story in this scenario? So yes, it is a text heavy exhibit. And I realize even visually, because a lot of the, visuals we have that demonstrate this history are things like advertisements that say whites only, right? And so even then the pictures we have are themselves text panels in that way. So, it is something, it can be a lot to take in, but also I think it's something that can be consumed in smaller chunks, right? It's not something you have to like read left to right every panel to get the point of the exhibit. It's something that absolutely you can come in, you can interact with it as makes the most sense with, for yourself. And I think still take a lot away from it.
I think too, if we had filled this exhibit with objects, I think that might detract from the actual stories, because it's easy to see a Klan robe and just go, and then not read a text panel and hear the story behind it. And one of the other things I want to jump back to a minute, you talked about looking at census records and seeing that an African-American population slowly disappeared from Astoria. And I think that's part of the difficulty in telling a story like this, because we can suspect why that happened. I mean, if you see a bunch of Klans guys walking around in big rallies, but we don't know, was there violence? Were there threats? We're assuming, but we don't really know that. It's not documented.
Right. No, that is some of the challenge. And, specifically to that, one of the things I was saying that, I'd come across but couldn't include in the exhibit absolutely because I couldn't confirm it was vandalism and violence against Japanese residents following the bombing of Pearl Harbor. I got sort of secondary accountings of that, but could never quite concretely say, yes, this absolutely happened and it happened in this space. So I had to, there's an allowance within the exhibit that there was some accounts of violence, but not, we can't quite concretely say, yep, absolutely.
Sure.
Here this is, it's documented, because it's not. And also to the one point, also thinking about the Klan, another thing, we do focus on the Klan, but a big thing about the exhibit also that talks about is just housing policy, right? So the Klan was here, they were scary, they were terrible. But housing policy overall probably did more to shape, the post-World War II demographics of Astoria than anything else.
And who was in charge of that at the time? I mean, was that not the city?
That was something that happened on a federal level. The Federal Housing Authority, their policy. So this is not unique to Astoria. This part is not unique to Astoria, but it certainly shapes Astoria.
Right. Interesting.
And do you have a specific example you want to share?
Sure. one thing, I'm a big fan is maybe too strong a word, but I believe absolutely in, holding yourself accountable. So one of the properties highlighted in the exhibit is my house, because my house, when it was built in 1947, had a racially restrictive covenant in the title. Those have since been deemed illegal by the Supreme Court. Those are no longer in play, but there it is. And that is something that certainly importantly shaped the demographics of that story, and something, I have to think about, like, what does it mean to live in a house that itself had this in the original title?
That when it was built,
right,
it was already limited of who could purchase or live in that house.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah. And that just seems so, it seems obscenely late, 1947, but obviously we know it wasn't by any means, with civil rights coming in the 60s, and fights still continue along those lines.
Right, absolutely.
So did you learn that first, or did you learn that during your research?
And to the point of like what it takes to make an exhibit, I ponder exhibits for years possibly. So it's hard to say exactly
where
in this process that knowledge came to be. But it's certainly something that as I was contemplating this exhibit, that information came out separately, but also then seemed relevant to include.
For sure. Yes. Yeah.
But we don't put a big sign, Chelsea's house.
Right,
right.
Chelsea lives here.
Although you did kind of just out that somewhere. On that map. So talk about the new exhibit that's under development.
Oh, absolutely. So 1922, as hopefully people know, December 8th, Astoria burns to the ground. So coming up on 2022, as we are actually now shockingly in, we are at the centennial of that fire. And so we are putting together an exhibit in our Parker Gallery, which is our larger gallery at the Heritage Museum, that commemorates that fire and the rebuilding of Astoria.
And I assume that exhibit's really easy to put together because we can just take all the artifacts from the fire.
Right. Oh, yes, right. So it turns out when you have a giant fire, everything burns down. And not much remains. And we actually have a museum dedicated to firefighting. So I think I came into this exhibit a little naively, thinking it would come together quickly, but it did not. Once I actually went through our collection and assembled every single thing we had that had, you know, was a relic of the 22 fire, it fit in a banker's box.
So we thought about just putting that box in the middle of the giant gallery with nothing else.
Right, yeah, yeah. Well, and we in a corner of the gallery, we sort of did. But but so we, you know, had lots of jokes, lots of things to think about, like, well, I guess we could just put piles of rubble in the middle of the gallery. And but what we actually came to was, you know, reading through a lot of accounts of the fire. You know, the fire is burning for about 10 hours, and so people are trying to save the goods from their store, from their homes, or their apartments, etc. And so you have all these accounts of people taking all their possessions, moving them into the street, realizing the fire is coming closer to them, moving them further down the street, realizing the fire is coming closer again, and just continuing this process until they either successfully get their stuff out of there or have to abandon it. Reportedly, when the fire was put out, the whole perimeter of the fire was just surrounded with like mattresses and furniture and rubble. So, an important part of this exhibit is what we've been fondly calling the pile of stuff, in which we kind of try to recreate the feeling of the chaos of having to, you know, frantically move your stuff out and what it would be and how this experience of just people, again, stuff everywhere.
See, and I love this when you told me about the idea to do this way, it resonated for me because my parents lived in New Mexico and they had to evacuate once for a fire and they had 2 hours notice. Mm. So it wasn't, hey, I'm just glad to get out of here. There was time to actually load the car. And I was fascinated by their thought process. I said, what did you load up? And some of the things struck me as very strange that they chose, and other things like, oh, the chair that our grandfather hand carved. I was like, well, that makes sense. So I'm kind of curious, and I'm fascinated by hopefully making that connection with visitors of what would you take?
Right.
And, right. You know, I mean, like right now, what would you two take if you had an hour to load up and get out? I mean, what are the most important things?
For a wildfire, I'd take my children and just go ahead of the crowd.
Yeah, I think so too.
But if she had time to load the car? You know, are there family albums, or now do we just take the flash drive of a photo? So that's an easy one.
As I live in Southern California, a friend of mine had to evacuate for a fire, and it was supposed to be a you rush right out and you don't bring anything evacuation, but she didn't do exactly that. What she grabbed was her, well, we were in grad school, so she grabbed her laptop first and foremost, because that would be a massive loss. And she grabbed her wedding photo album. And those were the two things that she took with her. Like, you know, these important memories and also the current project that she was well underway with.
I had a college professor once that had to evacuate. And he talked about he took their college diplomas. I'm like, why? That can be reprinted. That can, I mean, that's checkable. That yes, you did in fact graduate. Yes, you do have a degree.
Right.
And I was always struck by what an odd choice. So what kinds of things did people take? What do the newspapers talk about in this pile of stuff being?
And one of the funnier stories we have, and this one actually appears in our quarterly Cumtux, is a local gentleman, and he was a kid during the fire. And he kind of makes fun of, and well, I guess for years they made fun of his father because in the midst of this need to evacuate, he grabs the vacuum cleaner he had just bought their mom. And that's all he grabs. And the son makes this joke. He's like, not important papers, not just the vacuum cleaner.
So we are, in fact, looking for a vacuum cleaner from 1922 for this exhibit.
1920s vacuum cleaner to lend.
I'm sure there's one out there.
We'd be happy to borrow.
But it's got to look brand new.
Right. That's been the other thing, because we do have a lot of objects in our collection from the early 1920s, but some of them are in better repair than others. And if you're trying to recreate what it would actually be in 1922, it would be less tarnished, hopefully.
There you go. Well. Somebody's basement somewhere.
So there are lots of photos. So we really don't need any more photos because frankly, they're probably duplicates of ones that are already in our collection.
We actually have so many photos of the fire that at some point someone pulled out all the duplicates because they're actually in postcard form and put them for sale in our store. So we have plenty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if there are actual artifacts of some kind.
Yeah. Actually, if people do somehow, they have a, long held family heirloom that was something that survived the fire. Also, we have a few things that are actually souvenirs of the fire that were made after the fact. And if somebody has something of that nature, they would be interested in loaning us. I would love to hear from them. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And as always, how do they contact you?
They contact me. Email is probably the best way. It's my name, Chelsea V, CHELSEAV, at astoriamuseums.org.
Okay.
And how long will this exhibit, will this be all year?
It will be all year. The fire happens in December 1922, so it should be up through at least December 2022.
We'll take it down right afterwards.
Right, December 9th, this thing comes down.
And have an exhibit about cleaning up.
That sounds great.
Using the vacuum cleaner, we'll clean up. And the blocked out exhibit, technically it's a temporary exhibit, but it's in a room that we haven't really used as an exhibit space before. So I kind of feel like until we need that space, we're going to leave the exhibit up because we would like to add to it.
I think just, again, it's a really, I think, important exhibit, and it's something that has the potential to evolve. So, as we have this exhibit, as we have people interacting with the exhibit and getting just a better sense of the exhibit itself, I think certainly it'll be something that will continue on in some format or another.
Okay. So if you want to get the most bang for your buck, you can get a membership to Clatsop County Historical Society. It's January, so you get a full year.
That's right. For just $35 for an individual membership, and you can come in whenever, anytime all the time,
you want.
Anytime we're open.
And if it's more than one person, you get the next level, which is a family.
Family membership at 55.
Okay.
Or even higher levels.
Well, and you can always donate.
That's true. We always accept donations.
Do not say no.
So in about a minute, how does an exhibit come to play? I mean, how do you, we danced around it a little bit, and you're always thinking about exhibits,
right.
But we make a decision to do a fire exhibit. What are the steps that are involved in this process?
There's research, but with the fire exhibit especially, there's also seeing what research has already been done, because there's no reason for me to reinvent that wheel necessarily. There is the sort of the planning of the layout and the, and it's not just me. There's meetings, across the staff. There's kind of determining what needs to be built, because certainly, our facilities manager, Matt, he does a great job, building things and making these, my crazy plans happen. I come here, I'm like, Matt, I have this thing, it's impossible, give me a good solution. And usually within 24 hours, he has something, so that's convenient. We have to come up with what images we're going to use. We have to get, either depending upon the sizing, print them ourselves or get them printed. We have to write the text, print the text. So it's several steps.
So it's not just, hey, we decide to do this and then we put everything out.
Right. No.
Because I think sometimes people think that.
Yeah. No. I it's not just my own long process that I contemplate things for a long time. It actually is a quite an involved process putting an exhibit together.
Well, thank you so much. We appreciate your time and thanks for sharing with us.
All right. Go make some history and come on into the Heritage Museum numerous times this year to see great new exhibits. Go make some history. We'll catch you next week. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for joining us for An Adventure in History. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical Society and brought to you by KMUN.